And we're back in the studio, ready to create some podcast magic. Reggie in the booth, looking at the dials, bouncing as I speak. Are they bouncing in the correct way, in the correct manner? Very good, sir. Mic is hot. Talent is hot. And ready, per usual. All right. And yes, I just celebrated a birthday recently. Yes, I feel older. I'm stopped counting, so we won't even mention it. Let's just move on. Okay. Three S's, and then we'll get this baby into the runway for takeoff. Okay, here we go. Star, smile strong, and 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Posted every Monday at WGNplus.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Because this is one of your favorites, it's found there too. Don't forget, wherever you find this, on a regular basis or weekly basis, subscribe, rate, and most important of all, tell your friends, pass it on, send a link, send an email, whisper in their ear, whatever you do, tell your friends that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and they should listen too. If you're new to the podcast, or if you have been a long-time listener, your listening is much appreciated. And if you like what you hear now or what you've been hearing lately, you might want to go back into the archives. And that's easy to do, too. You just go to the landing page at WGNplus.com, press the entertainment prompt, go into Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there you will find all previous 189 episodes. Which means, do the math. As always, show your work. But as I'm counting on my fingers, it can only mean one thing. Welcome to podcast number 190. 190. So what I wanted to talk about today on the podcast here is we all have these visions of grandeur, don't we? There are moments when we're just by ourselves and we are thinking of those million-dollar ideas that we might have. And you hear so many stories of how so many of the great inventions or the most successful products or the most successful services were basically hatched very simply. Somebody was in a situation and they said to themselves, or they said out loud, why isn't there a blank? And rather than just floating that thought out into the ether, they actually sat down and said, not only should there be this specific product or this specific service, but I'm going to make it happen. Now, sometimes people are already in that business and it's an offshoot, or sometimes they're just in their basement with an idea. And you hear these stories of how people scratched together money and started some of the biggest companies in the world that are worth multi-billions of dollars, and they started with a $5,000 loan from their parents. I think that's, you know, the way Apple started, you know, in Steve Jobs' garage with a relatively small initial investment. And most of these things do not happen overnight, but they happen with ambition and ingenuity and drive and smarts, and a big part of it, You can have all those things, all those textbook things that you need to have a successful company. And the one thing you really need, which you can't buy, is luck. Actually, two things. Luck is 1A, and 1B is timing. So oftentimes, a multi-billion dollar idea comes along and becomes so successful because it is hitting at the exact time. The timing is right, and that's part of the luck. Many times, many of the great inventions or discoveries or initial ideas, many of them had been thought of before, and maybe they didn't come to market with the same kind of marketing push or funding, or it was just that the time was wrong. Same idea, wrong time. The public wasn't ready for it. The public didn't see a need for it at that time. And maybe 5 years or 10 years later, suddenly all stars aligned. I bring this up because I'm not ready to start my own billion-dollar company. I certainly would love to. Who wouldn't, right? But from my everyday experiences, walking around observing things, I sort of came up with a couple of recent observations that I think might be million-dollar ideas, or at least cool ideas. I don't know the monetary value of them, but I certainly think that they're kind of cool. And I'm gonna just share them with you. And maybe they are and maybe they aren't. And maybe they are $1 million, and maybe someone listening to this will jump on this, and I'll be biting my lip for having told somebody about it. But I just thought as I said, a lot of these ideas come to people just as you're making observations. The way I understand it, Uber, for instance, the idea for Uber came organically because I believe two young guys were out clubbing somewhere in France and near Paris or in Paris. I'm not sure where. I know they were somewhere in Europe, and it was early in the morning hours, and I don't know where they were, but they couldn't find a cab to get home. And they were very frustrated. They were waiting on a corner. Maybe the club they were in or wherever they were coming from was in a really high traffic part of the city. But whatever the reason, they could not find a cab, and they were very frustrated. And they looked at one another and said, "Why is it that we can't get transportation? Wouldn't it be great if there was a way using our phones that, you know, we could flag down that there would be cars available, and we could just go on our phone and find a car driving around and jump in?" Now, I've talked about Uber, and I've talked about how I think it's digital hitchhiking. We've been through that. I've talked about that. But still, the idea itself, in terms of the need for rideshare, certainly is there. As I said, I have nothing wrong with the idea. I have a few concerns of the safety, but the idea clearly was a sound idea. It was a need that wasn't being met, and the founders of Uber met the need. Now, how they've done it and how they will do it in the future remains to be seen. And as I said, there are certainly some safety concerns that have come up of late. But that main idea was born out of an experienced need. Two people saying, "Why isn't there this?" And they made that happen. Now, my ideas are not going to change the world by any means, but I think they're just kind of cool, neat ideas where you go, "Well, that would be neat. That would be cool." And so I just thought I'd share them with you. Maybe you have some. Do you have a million dollar idea that's just kind of floating there? Have you ever taken the plunge and gone that extra mile of not just thinking about it and saying, "Wouldn't it be cool?" But have you actually gone the next step and looked into it and maybe even started it, whether it's failed or not? That's certainly a a valiant effort to even decide to make that step, to invest money and to take the risk. Any business, whether it's a product or a restaurant or any kind of business or service that you start, is always a risk. And that's true for people who have already been successful in one area of business and have decided to go into another one. And it's amazing how in one business they are moguls and they go into another business and they are complete failures. And many of the times it has to do with expertise. As I said before, many a times it has to do with luck. But even if you've tried and failed, you still deserve a lot of credit. It's worth a pat on your back for taking that next step, because many of us, me included, don't ever take that next step. But as I said, this one is, these ideas are just out there. And maybe you have some. I'd love to hear them. As I said, we can't talk in the immediate, but you're always free if you listen to my podcast. I always post it on my Facebook page, and feel free to, you know, make a comment about maybe a business venture that you started and at one time that either has been successful or maybe it hasn't been, but was kind of a cool idea and you really wanted to see it through. Maybe it was one of your dreams. One of the most famous get rich quick folks was the character Ralph Cramden from The Honeymooners, and anybody who listens to me with any regularity knows that I'm a diehard Honeymooner fan. I know all 39 classic episodes by heart, and whenever I think of a get-rich scheme or kind of an idea to make money, I always think back of some of the cool ideas that Ralph Cramden had.
Sure, there's our television set over there. Don't you remember, Ralph? That's the one you bought out of the profits of that surefire investment of yours. Remember? The new invention that was going to do away with electric lights? Wallpaper that glows in the dark? There's our vacuum cleaner right over there, Ralph. Isn't it a beauty? You know how we got that? I bought it as soon as the money started just rolling in from that other investment of yours that couldn't miss. The uranium field in Asbury Park. And we don't need a new washing machine, Ralph. That one over there is just fine. Do you remember the scheme that got us that one? No-cal pizza? Would you like me to point out the rest of the
thing? No, you don't have to. You don't have to, just because I made a couple of mistakes. Nobody's 100%, Alice.
You are. You've been wrong every time.
Oh, poor Ralph. Alice gives it to him there. Just a few of his crazy harebrained schemes. But so I just thought I would maybe share some ideas that I recently had. I don't know if they have any real merit, but I just thought they were kind of cool. So the first idea that I had, my wife and I were going to a restaurant that was on a roof, on an upper level of a hotel. And so we got in the elevator, and we were with another couple, and it was a small elevator. And as the door was closing, another young woman walked in as well. And that was all that could fit in the elevator. It was kind of small. And there was a lot of people waiting to get in the elevator to go next. It was like, oh, I'm sorry. And the door's closed. And so, as you know, we had to go up several floors. And as we were in this kind of smaller, cozy elevator, I was just looking around, and as I said, there was a couple that we came with, but there was a woman there that, you know, did not know it all, and she's just kind of looking at her phone. And so as we're in this elevator going up, and you know, being in an elevator is always a weird experience, isn't it? I mean, we never know where to look, we never know whether to talk, we look at the numbers, we never know where to stand, we don't know where to look up, to look down, to look someone in the eye. It's a very odd experience to ride an elevator. Even when you're by yourself, you don't know what to do, because you sort of do know that someone's watching. There's a camera in there somewhere, so you have to be careful not to, you know, pick or scratch. But the elevator, it's confining, and some people, you know, even have claustrophobia in those. But even if you don't, you walk in there. I don't know about you, but I always hope that when the elevator doors open for me to go up or down an elevator, I always pray that it's empty. Don't you? When those elevators open and the elevator is empty, oh, I feel like I won the lottery. I don't have to worry about where to look to talk with. And it's just a weird little situation in there, you know. And then a lot of times, if there are people already in there, you walk in there and they're having a conversation. And many times people act like they're not even there and they're talking about personal things. And it's like, you know, I just think the elevator is made to be quiet. It's a conveyance. It's not a social compartment. Unless you're just with your own group. But if you're with other people, I don't think an elevator is a social gathering. It's a conveyance. It's to get from one place to the other. And you're not going to make a new friend in the elevator. And no one needs to hear your story about your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your horrible boss or your wife or your dog or whatever, or your kids and their recital. Whatever it is, no one really wants to hear it. I just need to get from the fifth floor to the eighth floor as quick as possible. at least that's the way I feel. A lot of that maybe comes from the fact that when I was a little kid, my mom, she was a very social person. She would and loved to talk to anyone. And maybe that's why I am relatively shy, even though I don't mind talking on the radio to, you know, many thousands of people or doing a podcast or getting up on a stage in front of people. I enjoy public speaking and I enjoy public performing. But when it comes to one-on-one situations, especially with strangers, I'm very shy. And I always take a step back. I don't just initiate, conversations. I'm not all that gregarious around strangers at all. In a comfort zone with my friends, I'm certainly outgoing, but I'm not initially that first person to start a conversation. And I think it might be from the fact that I used to get very easily embarrassed as a young kid because my mom would talk to anybody. If we were in a line, you know, for a movie, or if we were in an elevator, or we were anywhere, my mom would immediately strike up a conversation. My mom would go up and to the point where I'm wondering, I'm sure some people thought she was pretty forward and almost, you know, annoying or obnoxious. To the point where, and she always did it very good-naturedly, and she was always complimentary of people. When she would bring them up, she would say, she would start a conversation by kind of saying to a woman, for instance, "Oh, I really like that dress," or "I like your hair." I mean, I don't know why she felt the need to do it, but she did. But it was never mean spirited, and it was always in good natured, and it was always, you know, in a way to compliment somebody. My mom used to love looking at women's wedding rings. And she had a very nice wedding ring herself, nothing to sneeze at, but she would always grab a woman's hand and look at their, and say, "Oh my God, look at that beautiful ring." And a lot of times people, you know, the people were complimented, but at first it was kind of a forward act. And in today's world, with everybody being so germ conscious, I mean, this was fine, you know, 20, 30 years ago, even 15 or 20 years ago, but I don't know how people would react now if my mom would just grab their hand and say, "Oh, let me look at your ring," because I think people would just get freaked out. There's such a sense today of private space and germophobes. So I think my mom was in the right time. Talk about timing earlier. She was, whenever she did that, it was the right time to do it, because I don't think it would have really been appreciated in today's world. But I used to get so embarrassed, because some people would certainly begin to talk to her and they'd have this little conversation, just a little chit-chatty conversation. It didn't last more than a couple of minutes because, like I said, usually it was in a line or usually it was in an elevator. But sometimes I remember seeing people just kind of nodding and not being into it. And my mom would, and she caught the signs. She was savvy enough to know when someone was into it or not. But I just, as a little kid, you know, anything your parents do when you're a little kid is embarrassing, right? Even if they do something very cool. So if they're doing something that kind of feels embarrassing, it's even worse. And so we would be, you know, in an elevator, and I'd be like, please, Mom, don't talk. I mean, it used to be, I would say it into my head all the time, but sometimes I would even say it to her before, as the doors open, please, can you not talk to anybody in the elevator? Most of the times my protest fell on deaf ears. But she was just very social. She just liked to talk to people. But it did embarrass me, you know, quite a bit. And so maybe that's why when I'm in an elevator, I clam up because of that, being embarrassed as a little kid about my mom always talking to people. Maybe that's my problem. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's okay to strike up a conversation. Or maybe in your view, an elevator is a very social situation and no problems with that. I just have an aversion to it. And maybe it's from this. I was, you know, from early childhood, I was always embarrassed that my mom would talk to anyone. And I just kind of, so when I get into an elevator now, I will go to the back or to the very side and I will put my head down. And I will just glance at the, you know, at the numbers. Now in today's world, it's very easy to sort of be in your own and not be social because of the cell phone, you know, because of your iPhone. Anybody who doesn't want to have any kind of social interaction and can easily send that sign before the smartphone, you know, you're both standing there. So maybe someone did strike up a conversation with you as just way to pass the time. But today with the smartphone, it's very easy to send a very definite signal to the next person there or the other people that you are not interested in conversing, because they'll just bury their heads in the phone and go swiping away. And I think that's a pretty good social signal that, you know, not interested in conversing in any way. But as you know, I don't have a smartphone. I don't have it in my hand all the time. So I'm just sort of in there, standing there with either my head down looking at the ground or looking at those numbers and just counting them down until I get to my floor. Look at me. Wow, what a trip. Huh? What a nice guy, right? But as I said, it might go back to those early days with my mom just being embarrassed. I don't know. So ironically, while the elevator seems to be kind of a conveyance or a situation that I'm not that you know, excited about or excited to be a part of. I just use it as this mode of transportation. Ironically, my idea is 180 degrees different from that. My idea is turning the elevator into a social situation, but once again, on my terms. If you remember, I said earlier, I enjoy being in a group of friends, and I will be very outward and you know, hold court or whatever it is. But when I'm with strangers, I'm not as initially the outgoing type, which seems very adverse to my personality. But it really is the truth. But once a conversation starts, I'll jump in. But I rarely am the conversation starter in a social situation like that. And yet here's my neat idea, my supposedly million-dollar idea, and it's completely opposite of what I just said. So we're in this elevator, and even though there is this other stranger in there, there's another couple and my wife, so I'm sort of in a familiar situation where I don't mind starting the conversation because I'm more in a comfort zone. Even though there's one stranger in there, I'm with three other people that I'm comfortable with. So then I do sort of, you know, make the first move. So as we're in this elevator going up, and we had to go up several floors, the fact that it was very small and kind of intimate, and the fact that there was a lot of people waiting to get on and the doors closed with only us five in there. As we started to go up, I looked around at the elevator, and I just kind of blurted out, just this idea struck me. And I said, wow, You know, wouldn't it be cool if you could rent an elevator for a half hour and it was like an intimate date situation? So there was this dedicated elevator in a building that you make a reservation for. And in this elevator, there's a small table with two chairs, you know, not even a big crowd, just two chairs, a small table, and it is connected or affiliated with a restaurant, okay? Dedicated elevator with a table, two chairs. You're able to order some small plate dishes like appetizers and your favorite drink of choice, whether it's a bottle of wine or, you know, some kind of drinks, and you reserve this elevator for a half hour, and you ride the elevator up and down over the course of this half hour, and it goes at sort of a slow speed. Now, ideally, it would be an elevator that was a glass elevator that had a view to the outside. That would be the ultimate thing. Because then you'd have this amazing view of the outside. In Chicago, for instance, where I'm at, it'd be great if you were in a downtown hotel and you have a view of the lakefront or of the skyline or of the river. But even if you were in a building that all four, you know, walls were closed, you would have the lights would be dimmed, and you could even, you know, there would be a little port where you plugged in your iPhone with your playlist, and you could play your favorite music in this little elevator with the lights dimmed and your favorite drink and some food, and you slowly went up and down on this elevator for like a half hour and just spent some quiet quality time in this elevator, kind of secluded from the world and having this feeling of motion. I think you wouldn't be able to reserve. I think the reservations for that would be full for 2 years. I just think if it was, and it wouldn't be overly decorated. I think the coolness of it is the fact that it is an elevator. You don't want to un-elevator the elevator. You know, the lure or the appeal of the loft apartment is the fact that, yeah, this used to be some kind of a factory or a warehouse. And so, yeah, there's the bricks of that wall. You know, there are some outward signs of the previous use of this building that was not a living space, but a working space. And I think it's the same way here. There could be some decoration, but I think that that a lot of times, you know, every elevator is different too. Think about it. The design and the look of every elevator is different. Some are very classic looking with wood in them. They have that feel of like an old library. Some are very cool and hip. With whites, white colors and very sharp and lines with just black and white. Some of them are metallic. So every elevator has its own identity to begin with. So I don't think you mask that. I don't think you try to make this, into some kind of a room. That's the cool part of it. All the time we know it's an elevator. You know, we will be as we're up there, we could still see those numbers changing as we get to the bottom, and then the elevator automatically goes down then and up then and down then. How many times it can be calibrated, I'm sure, that within a half hour, depending on how tall the building is, you get four trips up and down. Four trips up, four trips down in a half hour. I don't know. I think a half hour is enough, though, because then I think it gets a little boring. But I think after the initial kind of thing, when those doors close and the you know, the hostess says, we'll see you in a half hour. Think of that. The elevator's door closed and you have that elevator to yourself and it's quiet with your music. And like I said, the lights could be a little dimmed. And for a half hour, you've got some quality alone time away from the craziness of the world in this elevator. And it's slowly moving up and down. And as I said before, if it's a glass elevator and you can look outside, even better. Now, talk about, you know, a nice romantic kind of mood. But that, I think, would be an amazing first date. I mean, if you own a if you own one of these dating websites and these dating apps, a side part, a sideline to your business, I think, is the is this intimate elevator. That's what I would call it, the intimate elevator. Maybe there's another name for it. I haven't thought of the name yet. That intimate elevator is just something I just thought of 2 seconds ago. But I just thought as we were in this elevator, and so the best part is, as I said, this is kind of a joke to my wife and our two friends. The other woman who was in the elevator, who I did not know, and who was a young woman, probably in her late 20s, early 30s, she had her head down, perfect. She was doing perfect etiquette. She was the stranger in this elevator with four people that knew one another. So she was doing exactly what I described earlier. She had her head down, looking into her phone, and she was swiping. She was basically, you know, feeling like, okay, there's four other people that know one another. I'm just here on my own. I have to get to where I need to go and put my head down, look at my phone. She was doing exactly that. And so when I set out, you know, so now, you know, she's kind of the odd person out. The four of us know one another. And I sort of blurt out, wouldn't it be cool if there was a table in here and we were able to sit down? And perfect stranger, I sort of did I gave the elevator pitch. I gave an elevator pitch of an elevator pitch in an elevator. All of a sudden, her head lifted up from her phone, and she looked right at me and said, that's really a good idea. And I'm like, I looked at her, I said, yeah, isn't it? And, you know, my wife and our friends kind of nodded, and it's like, and all of a sudden you could see sort of the wheels in their head moving too, like, well, that is kind of a new idea. I never thought of that. Now, as I said, I am not a restaurant owner. I am not a hotel owner. I don't know how this would work. I don't know the logistics of it. You know, in any kind of a building, a building that's already up, obviously, you know, elevator space is important. It's a mode of transportation. People want to get to their floor as quick as they can. I know the idea of, putting one elevator out of service to serve people going to their floors and have it solely dedicated to this kind of intimate elevator it might not be attractive to businesses to say, no, I can't give up a whole elevator to do that. We've got people going up here all the time. As I said, maybe it's just, you know, for, you know, certain times from 7 to 10 in the evening. Especially once again in a building where there is a restaurant, maybe that's up at the top of it. And there are several of those, whether it's a hotel or it's an office building, because that's a natural tie-in. You know, you have your appetizer there, you do this half hour thing of going up and down, and then you end up at the top and the door is open, and then you go for your meal. Isn't that cool? I'm sorry, but I think that's cool. I would do that. And it doesn't have to be overly expensive. You know, I mean, once again, it's for the price of the wine and maybe your BYOB, right? Bring your own music, bring your own, and maybe you wanted to bring your own food. You know, you can maybe, hey, that's, I'm just coming, once again, spitballing here. Maybe you bring your own food, or maybe you don't want to have food. Maybe you bring your own bottle of wine. And you bring your music, as I said. You have a little USB port in there to play your music. So maybe all that that needs to be offered is this little sanctuary, just this table with a couple of chairs. And it's the sanctuary of having this intimate experience in this moving little room. I'll never forget the first time I ever went to Disneyland, even before Disney World was born, or was made. I was a little kid, and there was only Disneyland in California. And I'll never forget if you ever remember going to the Haunted Mansion, which I think this year is actually celebrating its 50th or 6th, it's some anniversary of the Haunted Mansion. There's even going to be a film, I believe, based on the Haunted Mansion ride at Disney. Or has there already been one? I know there's one going to be on the Jungle ride. Maybe there already has been a Haunted Mansion. I'm not sure. But anyway, one of the cool things about the Haunted Mansion ride, you will remember if you've ever been on it, at Disney World or Disneyland, but I remember being a little kid at Disneyland. If you remember how that ride begins, everybody gets into an elevator. Everybody gets into what they think is a room. And if you remember, there's pictures on the wall in this room. And then suddenly, much to your surprise, it's an elevator, and it goes down. And the cool part is that all those pictures that were initially of a person sort of sitting there doing something, as the elevator goes down, the pictures are revealed, and they're elongated, and there's more to the picture than first saw the eye. But you're physically going down in what you thought was a room. That's basically the idea here, except that you're not with 100 other people. You're only with another person. So there's my idea. The intimate elevator. I don't know if it's possible. As I said, I don't own a building. I don't own an elevator. I don't own a restaurant. But I think that if I had access to one to those and had access to an elevator to my restaurant or in my building, I think that would be a pretty cool service and experience to offer to people. And I think people would use it. And I think people would, for a first date or for a special birthday or a special occasion like an anniversary, I think that's a no-brainer. Once again, that's from me to you. Idea number two. As we sit here in January, the holiday season just ended, and part of the holiday season in many cities, including here in Chicago, certainly many cities in Europe, is the Christmas market, the outdoor market where they have little booths to sell merchandise and gifts, as well as food and drink. Outdoors, taken from the famous kind of outdoor Christmas markets in Europe, mostly started in Germany. The most famous is probably in Nuremberg, and I've been to that one, and it's very cool. Been to a lot of Christmas markets around the world through Europe, actually. My wife and I go to specific places around the holidays just to go to the markets, and a lot of people do that. And in Chicago, they've done a nice job of recreating those European Christmas markets here in downtown Chicago, at the Daly Center right downtown. And over the last several years, they've had some in the suburbs. And even one that we went to this year, right outside of Wrigley Field, in this little area called Gallagher Way, which is kind of a picnic area during the season. And it's much smaller, but it was very cool. And to have Wrigley Field as a backdrop for it, with those little booths and the little cabins they have there. And they had a nice little skating rink and stuff. It was very cool. But a highlight of the food is the food at the Christmas market. And it's usually very hearty comfort food because you're outside in the winter. So there's hot chocolate, obviously, or coffee. But then there's usually, because they are, as I said before, European influenced, whether it's mostly a German influence or an Austrian, there's kind of the Bavarian influence. There's other influences there from France and other European cities. And there are some really cool European foods that are offered. So there's, as I said, most of the time, you know, you can get some nice heavy comfort food for the winter at some of the stands and some of the stalls, like, you know, sausages or bratwurst or potato pancakes and hot dogs and things like that. Or crepes, French crepes, or different kinds of, you know, pastries and, you know, and hot chocolate and things like that. So they're, it's very good. If you go there, or the delicacies, you know, some desserts, you know, made right in front of you or sitting there. But it's certainly, you know, a nice venue for either, if you're in a specific city, what might be the you know, the favorite food of that European city, or like they have here in the Chicago area, it's kind of a nice little mix of many different countries and some of their specialties. So I don't know if you have been to one of these in the last several years, but a growing and one of the most popular foods at these outdoor Christmas markets over the last couple of years is I believe it's a French cheese. Might be Swiss, though, but I think it's French, called raclette. And if you've ever seen these at the Christmas markets, you know that it's this amazing, decadent sandwich that is basically, it's very simple. It's a half wheel of this raclette cheese, and the exposed side that's been cut is warmed, is heated by a heating element, and the cheese gets bubbly and gooey and melty. I would say about a half inch worth. They let it get a good little portion, and then when it's just bubbly and gooey, just before it's going to burn, they get a baguette or some kind of a bread or a bun, and they scrape the gooey cheese, this gooey raclette cheese, which is really good and gooey, onto this bread. And a lot of times, at least on the German side, traditionally, it will be on a kind of a French roll or a thick roll like that, like a baguette. And that's why I think this might be French, because it might be on a French baguette. But they skim that off, and then they put some onions, some little shallots maybe on there, and then oddly enough, a couple of little gherkin pickles, and that's the sandwich. And oh my gosh, this cheese is so good and so hot, because it's coming right off of this element, and it's all gooey. And oh my gosh! And then they have some other versions of this. You can have ham on it, jabon, if you will, or a bratwurst with the cheese scraped off on the bun. You know, and it's just the line usually for the raclette sandwich is the longest line at most of these Christmas markets. Now I remember first seeing this raclette sandwich at least 7 or 8 years ago in New York at a Christmas market that they have there annually in Bryant Park, which is right off the main library near 41st and 40th Street. And it's a great outdoor market there, right in down, and they have a big, you know, they have a tree there, and they have a big skating rink, similar like we have here. And as I said, many booths and stalls with different foods and different merchandise that you can buy. And we discovered the raclette just walking through there. I'd never seen that before. We've been to other outdoor markets in other cities, and I never saw raclette before. So, of course, I love cheese. Major cheese fan. And so I'm like, well, I have to get one of these. Well, the first time I had one, I was hooked. And many times when we would go to New York over the holiday just to get that raclette sandwich, because we couldn't get it anywhere. Well, now raclette has made its way to the Midwest, at least, as well as throughout Europe. Maybe that's where it started as well. But so now the raclette stand is a very popular stand right here and at the Christmas markets in Chicago. And so when we went to the Christmas market at Wrigley Field at Gallagher Way, sure enough, there's the raclette line. Now, I was very tempted to get the poutine. Now, do you know what poutine is? Once again, kind of a cheese-infused comfort food. Poutine is a Canadian food. It's a Canadian favorite. And what a combination this is. How do you not love this? And when we went to Canada, we went to Toronto, and that's where I really discovered and had my first poutine. French fries with melted cheese curds and brown gravy. Oh my God. I mean, where do you start? Unbelievable. So when I went to Gallagher Way, they had a place that had poutine. I was very tempted, but nowadays, poutine has become a popular menu item on a lot of restaurants, so you can get poutine in a restaurant. The raclette thing still seems to be confined, for the most part at least, that I've seen, to these outdoor Christmas markets. So it's kind of this annual thing, got to get a raclette sandwich. So sure enough, we go to the Christmas market, and there's the longest line at the raclette line. Now, when we went, even though we've had a relatively minor winter here in Chicago thus far, we went on one of the days when it was a little chillier, in the 30s. And so as much as I loved the raclette, and those first couple bites were amazing because the cheese was just scraped off. It was gooey and melty and stringy and warm and in the words of Homer Simpson, But then, because of the elements, because of outside, being in the cold and the 30-degree temperature, as you know, once the cold air hits something warm like that, especially like cheese, it will make it cold. It won't freeze it, but it will stop the gooiness, that's for sure. It makes it a little tougher and harder. And so while the sandwich was still good toward the end, it was not as good as those first three or four bites, when the cheese was still hot and gooey. It was still good, don't get me wrong. But as it was cold out, the cheese got affected by the elements and got cold, and it wasn't the warm, comforty, gooey, stringy, warm cheese nirvana that it was for the first three or four bites. And so as I was sitting there finishing my raclette sandwich, another light bulb lit up, similar to my intimate elevator light bulb idea. Notice how a lot of these things have to deal with food, right? The intimate elevator basically is a place to have a meal without being bothered by anybody, right? Once again, I love being social as long as I'm away from people. So as I'm eating my raclette sandwich toward the end, I'm saying to myself, geez, I wish it was still warm, you know. So then a light bulb goes on, and I say to myself, well, why is this raclette sandwich seemingly, at least in my universe, why is it seemingly relegated to just these outdoor, winter-based markets? This is not a difficult sandwich to make at all, which is one reason why it's so popular for these people at these outdoor booths, because you know all they do is get a heating element and plug it in and get a piece of, you know, a wheel of cheese, cut it in half and stick it underneath there and get, you know, some toasted buns, and they're in business. So in terms of easy preparation in an outdoor facility, you know, some, you go to some of these outdoor summer things, and these guys got, you know, vats of oil, and they're to cook that, whatever their specialty is. It's quite a big deal to bring in an oven to make a pizza or whatever it is. But my gosh, this raclette thing, the heating element is ridiculously small. You get a piece of cheese, it's going to be cold anyway. You get a wheel of cheese, you cut it in half, you get a few little toaster ovens there to warm up the buns, and that's all you need. You need, you know, an outlet with three, an electrical strip with like five outlets on it, and you're done. Simple. So my point is, if it's that easy to make, why is it not in a restaurant? And part of the experience of the raclette is that you're waiting in line for it. When it's your turn, you're just watching that cheese. It's amazing what, you know, we are a sophisticated, right, you know, a species here. We've flown to the moon, and yet a big hunk of melting cheese will hypnotize us. We will stop in our tracks. We've been to the moon. It doesn't matter. But when we see a half wheel of cheese melting and getting gooey, it stops us in our tracks and hypnotizes us. So a great part of the raclette experience is not just eating it, but it's the anticipation of watching that cheese getting that layer of cheese that's going to get scraped on that roll for you. Watch it melt in front of your eyes. And especially, don't forget, you know, we're out in the cold, so this heating element is giving off heat too, so you're actually benefiting from that. But my gosh, your stare is just concentrated on this layer of cheese that's melting before your eyes. What a sight. Melted cheese. Life doesn't get much better than this. And so, as I said before, it's a visual experience as much as a taste experience. And so I'm sitting here as I'm finishing my raclette outside in the cold, and it's gotten a little, you know, the cheese is not as gooey as it was. And I turn to my wife and I'm like, you know, why doesn't a restaurant serve raclette? And think about the, as I said before, about the visual presentation. It's made for table side service, right? You know, that's so cool. You know when they come to a nice restaurant and they'll make Bananas Foster's Cherry's Jubilee right in front of you, or there's a place in Chicago called Don Roth's that had the spinning salad bowl, and they would make the salad right in front of you at your table. That was the circus of the, that was the term that they used, of the dining experience, the fun of it. Of not just having food brought to you, but having food prepared for you right in front of you. I mean, that one of the lures that people have now is that, you know, a restaurant will have a small table in the kitchen, and you will be, you know, you'll watch them create the food right in front of you in the kitchen. Or a lot of places have tasting menus, and the chef will come out and explain what he's going to do, and sometimes they will prepare it at the table for you as well. But that's, in today's world, where restaurants are certainly competitive for diners, whatever you can do to heighten and elevate the entire experience, not just what you actually put in your mouth, but the visual aspect as well, you know, is a plus. You go to Las Vegas, they have people on floating in the air, and they have this, you know, shows going on literally, you know, in the restaurant. So I'm like, my gosh, the raclette is made for that. You order a raclette sandwich, they bring it on a little moving tray, and you sit there for a minute or two, and you watch the cheese melt right in front of you, and then right at your table, they scrape it right. In fact, you know, they open the bun on your plate right in front of you, and they tilt the half block of melted cheese and that layer, and they scrape it right on, right in front of you. Oh my God, it's made for it. Can't you hear like a choir of angels right behind you just playing that? And they scrape that gooey, melty cheese on your toasted baguette right on your plate in front of you. Oh, people would start clapping. It's made for that. And the added bonus is not just the visual, but unlike outside where the cold weather and the elements make the cheese cold, well, here you're indoors, so your raclette sandwich is going to stay warm and gooey for a longer period of time, hopefully through the whole process of eating the sandwich, as opposed to those first two or three bites, and then it gets a little cold. Now, I don't know if restaurants already are doing this or not. I have not seen it. But if you own a restaurant and you don't have raclette on the menu where you prepare it at the person's table, I think you're missing out on a huge, huge opportunity to create a unique dining experience that would draw people in specifically for that sandwich. They already know about it from the Christmas markets, and now you can get one in August at your table. We love melted gooey cheese. And to have it scraped off of a melted gooey cheese from a heating element right onto my plate, no brainer, folks. No brainer. Once again, I don't own a restaurant. I can't easily implement this. But I would think that if you have a restaurant, this one is made for you. So there you go, folks. Those are my two, I don't know if they're million-dollar ideas, but I think they're pretty cool ideas. They're all about experiences, and they're all about food, just one way or the other. The intimate elevator, you reserve an elevator, and you have a half-hour first date or half-hour anniversary celebration with a little table, a little bottle of wine or your favorite drinks, some small plate foods, and you go up and down this elevator. It's just your private elevator for 30 minutes. You make a reservation and you reserve the intimate elevator. How cool is that? Or you go to your favorite restaurant and you order a raclette sandwich, and it is prepared tableside. And the gooey cheese is scraped off from the cheese right onto your plate as you sit there. Oh, I don't know about you, but there's two places I'm going to. Those are my ideas. They're out there for you to either make your mouth water, to make your head nod, or to make you some money. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and most importantly, pass on the word to your friends that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. I hope you enjoyed episode number 190. I certainly enjoy doing it because I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. I am Jim Tirano, and you've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen. Melted cheese. Ha 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 ha.